cozy traditions feel good, especially this time of year. And that includes your fall makeup look. From lashes for days with liquid lash extension mascara to enhancing a smoky eye with your favorite shade of Brilliant Eye Brightener, Thrive Cosmetics is your go-to for completing every fall look. Whether you want a simple, just gotta get out the door routine or fall glam that wows at all your favorite festivities, you'll always look and feel radiant with Thrive Cosmetics. Plus, every product is vegan, cruelty-free, and made with clean, skin-loving ingredients. Complete your fall look. Go to thrivecosmetics.com/cozy for an exclusive offer of 20% off your first order. That's Thrive Cosmetics, CAUSEMETICS.com/cozy.
Off the ball, GAA.
Look, personally, I'm absolutely over the moon. Look, I was watching Donald Hughes, Kieran Hughes, Frank Coffey, Donald Morgan, Dermot McCrudden, Nicholas Carrigan. I could name them for hours. These boys soldiered for years. Didn't get to play a part in this, but they were playing a part in how we got here today.
Join in the obsession. Subscribe now at offtheball.com/join.
Off the ball, breakfast.
Yeah, you just had to be there.
You know, yeah, to be there.
And it was just great to say, like, Arlo was there for that. You know what I mean?
You had to be there. I wish I wasn't there. You had to be there.
All right, everybody, welcome back to Thursday morning's Off the Ball Breakfast with Vinnie Perth and myself. Delighted to still have your company this morning and thrilled now because it's the final You Had to Be There of a stacked You Had to Be There in 2025. And what better man to have with us for this honour than Sean Moran himself, the Irish Times GA correspondent. Sean, delighted to have you this morning. Welcome.
Thank you.
Great to have you in studio. First time in studio?
Not in News Talk. I'm not sure if I've been in here, but I've been in News Talk since it started on and off.
Yeah, yeah.
Back in 2004, I think it was.
Thrilled to have you here anyway. Yeah. We've plenty to get stuck into. Your picks are nicely condensed within the world of GA, but a bit eclectic too, with some rugby and soccer thrown in. But before we get to all of those, it was quite the year in GA. You wrote about it recently in the Irish Times, but to end with the champions in Kerry and Tipperary, quite a while since they both won, respectively,
yeah,
the same
really
year.
Yeah, surprised me.
Yeah, yeah.
You'd think, they're both so high up. Kerry top the Roll of Honour in football and Tipper in the top three. But they've only done it a couple of times in history. Yes.
Yeah.
I think you have to go back to the 60s.
62,
yeah, the last time that had happened, and then only a couple of years before that. So yeah, it was unusual in that sense, but it doesn't feel unusual, you know, when Tip and Kerry win All-Ireland.
Yeah, the fourth time ever, 1930, 1937, 62, yeah. And now 2025, and it did feel like a seismic year, because this time last year we were talking about, geez, like, Gaelic football is going to be unrecognisable and we don't know if it's for better or for worse.
Yeah.
What's your reflection 12 months in?
Yeah, It played out very positively. I mean, I think there was a lot of positivity about it at the end of last year. You know, when it swept through that special congress, and obviously there were sort of problems and things to be ironed out along the way. But in general, I think it started well and it maintained that trajectory. I suppose the only thing that, and it's hard to blame the rules for this, but the All-Ireland series fizzled out a little bit. The matches weren't as competitive at the end of the of the championship as many had been during the earlier stages. So that was a disappointment. But the rules themselves worked really well. I mean, you can even see in recent weeks in the club, you know, it's been some terrific club matches in football with the new rules kind of in the middle of it all.
On the club game, actually, do you think like that it's still kind of excessively parochial and or versus taking over the whole country's interest? Because you kind of a weekend will look at a report and say, okay, it ended that way, but maybe there's not great exposure to it nationwide. Maybe it doesn't need to be. Maybe that's the beauty of the club game.
Yeah, I think that's there's probably truth in that it remains a very localised affair, you know, the club starting off with the county championship and even the provincial championships. They're not huge box office, and the attendance is traditionally go down for the provincial championships. Now they pick up at the end as you get in sight of titles and the All-Ireland series. But I think it's been good, though, in terms of the split season and giving the club game an opportunity to breathe a bit. I don't think anyone suggests that the club can kind of take over the same profile that the inter-county has during the summer. But it provides some fairly interesting stuff. I mean, in both the football and hurling, particularly the football, has been really good over the last few weeks.
I was in Newbridge on Sunday watching Salons in
And a club from Meath. And what I found from a, like, obviously a soccer background, the sense of community around the game is off the charts. And Newbridge was fairly packed out on the day and with the intermediate game. But also has definitely become a better spectator sport as well for the neutral in terms of the new rules.
Yeah.
And particularly, you expect that to happen at inter-county level because the level of professionalism and the detail, but it's happening also in the club game, I think.
Yeah,
and
no,
that's my view. I don't know whether you...
No, it's an interesting point. No, it's an interesting point because if you remember, I mean, about 12 months ago, slightly longer before it was clarified, there was a lot of discussion, will these apply to the club game as well? Would it not be better to start them off at inter-county and then gradually introduce them? And the FRC took a kind of a bullish line on it, which was this will enhance the game both from a spectator's and a player's point of view, and it's unfair to deny club players the opportunity to play. And I think, yeah, you saw, I mean, with the Munster final and the FRC rules that were breached at the end and the two-pointer and everything. Yeah. I mean, it was a big bundle of FRC innovations. And I mean, terrible for Finbars that it ended the way it did and terrific for Dingle. But I agree with you. I think that the club matches have also benefited. I mean, there was talk, how will they know? Like, how will they keep track of the 4-3, you know, and everything? But to an extent, it's self-policing. You can see, like, teams aren't shy about sticking up the hand and it's been, I'm surprised it hasn't been more of a problem than it has. But
there was two infringements of not leaving three up. That happened twice in the game. But it was almost, like you said, self-police, where the team that made the mistake sort of knew it was their own mistake and fought with themselves and fixed it going forward. But I think the attacking flair now on offer is what's really exciting from a neutral GAA man. I think the attacking flair in the football game, even at club level, some of the, like 117, 115 you're seeing, or 2-7, it's really brilliant to see.
I think that 4-3 core provision has a lot to do with it, because you're isolating forwards up front, and they're not being required to, you know, someone like Stephen Sherlock, who was shot the lights out for St. Finbar's, like, he's not required to track back.
Yeah.
He's always one of the three that's up. And I know it's created space. I mean, you know, you could see it in the inter-county game that Kerry win the All-Ireland, but they win it because they have the best forwards in the game, and the new rules have kind of provided the space for that to thrive and prosper. Yeah. And of course, they're that Kerry thing of being able to kind of click into form when they got to Croke Park, and about, you know, they lost all the kind of the difficulties and the uncertainties they'd had earlier in the summer and just kind of drove on. But it was very much forward led, the All-Ireland.
On the calendar throughout the year, balancing inter-county and club, there kind of seems to be some sort of war there for certain people. What about Glenn's statement that we saw in recent weeks about the future of the club game in jeopardy with the inter-county season being extended by even a week or two? And it's an extremely long and detailed statement with a lot of emotion attached as well. What are your thoughts on it?
I think it would have been better to keep it as it was. But
previous to where we are now.
No, sorry. It would have been better to keep it as it was this year, because the new recommendation that the season extend for 2 weeks into August. I'm not sure there was a need for it. So I know people say it's too compressed and the focus falls away too quickly. But for the club game, I think it's been really good to have that extra space. And for, you know, in Cork, Kevin O'Donovan's been very strong on this.
Yes, he's been on with us,
And he was on the committee, so in other words, they got him on board. It's like Michael Collins been brought in to okay this act of treachery. But he made the point, and he was right, look, this, we can live with this, but this is the extent of it. And if we live with this, you got to drop the pre-seasons and you know, make up for it that way.
So as an outsider's view, though, I think the top of the game is weaker as a result of these changes. So the inter-county game is, weaker is the wrong word, but it's certainly not as prominent in terms of Irish sport as it was a couple of years ago, because it's into this little narrow window, and when it's gone, it's gone.
Yeah,
but so for the floating support is what I mean.
Yeah, but that was probably always the case, though, to an extent. I mean, most teams, most counties were done by the time we got to August, and it did stretch out and engage, okay, and it engaged schools and things, and that was seen as a problem. But at the heart of all this was the idea that we have to fix the fixtures for the clubs, and the clubs are providing, you know, whatever it is, 98% of the activity, and if you like, the promotional needs of the intercounty game had to take a bit of a hit on that. But the GA decided that's what we must do. After lots of fiddling around the edges, this was the way to do it. And I think you're right, Vinnie. I mean, the point is that there isn't the same. I mean, you're losing 2 months for a start.
Yeah.
That's 2 months of, and also it's creating clashes with other sports, particularly the early stages of the championship. You're running into things like the Champions Cup in rugby, yeah, at the end of the soccer season. But there's always been a bit of that with the GA, you know, if there's a World Cup year or a European Championship year, and particularly if Ireland are involved in it, the attendances kind of get a bit of a hit. But, you know, afterwards they keep going. So I think you're right, there has been a bit of suffering, but it's been, it's a concession that they decided was worth.
Who decided, though?
The GA.
Yeah, but they're predominantly, the clubs are the biggest voice.
Yeah.
So my question, from an elite, and no elite player will say what I'm about to say, but they may be thinking it. I want to be an elite athlete, which a lot of them at inter-county level are, but I've got to go back to my club, who might only be an intermediate club, it might even be a junior club, and sort of train at a lesser standard for 6 months of the year, where I want to be elite, I want to be the face of sport in Ireland, but we're pigeonholed into a smaller thing because the club game want to grow.
Yeah, but you kind of referenced that yourself when you were talking about that kind of feeling of community at a club match.
Yeah.
And it, players are club players first. Now, some aren't thrilled at having to make the transition from the high profile of inter-county,
yeah,
particularly if they're not with a particularly strong club. But I remember in the pandemic summer back in 2020, and the season was inverted with the club matches first and the club championships first. And of course, it was brilliant for journalists, because no one was at the matches, so we drove straight up to the ground and went in. Yeah? There was no getting there an hour in advance and trying to park and all the rest. But I remember after the Dublin final, and Ballymun Kickhams had won, and Ballymun Kickhams, remember, at their peak, they had a lot of the really high profile Dublin players playing for them, you know, Dean Rock, James McCarthy, Philip McMahon, etc. And I remember after they'd won the final, talking to James McCarthy, and he was saying how brilliant it had been this year, because normally they engage with the club after a season that typically goes to an All-Ireland final, and often they won it, and then they have to reset immediately, get back to the club, and it's a hard adjustment to make. Whereas he said, this time we're able to train with our club mates, we're able to get to know the younger players, and it was really an enjoyable experience for them. So I would feel that that inter-county players often like to be able to give time to their club, and they also like the fact that they now have certainty, and they now have bits of the summer that the season will be over when they can make holiday plans and everything else. So again, it has been a compromise, but I don't think it's without advantages for inter-county players.
In your time, was there an era where the schedule was the most ideal?
Well, I think the current one is working, in the sense that it's giving. I know a lot of people, including colleagues of mine, would dispute that and say, like, the GA is losing out a lot in terms of profile. You're throwing away these weeks, particularly when, you know, soccer and rugby is only getting started. So the elite Gaelic games is going to get, you know, more of the coverage. But I think in terms of running the organisation as a sort of a balancing match between the elite players at inter-county level, and they don't want to, you know, undercut that too much, because that's the financial engine of the association is what comes in through the intercounty game, but also to understand, because I think the difficulties of club players had become almost comical, that they couldn't, could hardly plan a wedding or anything, because you just never knew when anything was going to go ahead. So, I mean, maybe it'll turn out in because we're only a couple of years into it, it'll turn out not to be such a great idea. But I think most of the evolutions have been for the better. I mean, when I started off, the league was partly played before Christmas, and so the inter-county season never seemed to end, and it's been kind of rationalised now, and more time is given to, and even now clubs will say, well, they don't, you know, that they too are a bit compressed, and they don't have their county players, you know, during the county leagues and that. But at the moment, I think it's worked okay.
Hiring isn't just about finding someone willing to take the job. You need the right person with the right background who can move your business forward. If you want candidates who truly match what you're looking for, trust Indeed Sponsored Jobs. With Indeed Sponsored Jobs, your post stands out to quality candidates who actually fit the role. According to Indeed data, 90% are more likely to be hired and trusted by 1.6 million companies. Spend more time interviewing candidates who check all your boxes. Less stress, less time, more results. Now with Indeed Sponsored Jobs. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to help your job get the premium status it deserves at Indeed.com/podcast13. Just go to Indeed.com/podcast13 right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/podcast13. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Do it the right way with Indeed.
Cozy traditions feel good, especially this time of year. And that includes your fall makeup look. From lashes for days with liquid lash extension mascara to enhancing a smoky eye with your favorite shade of Brilliant Eye Brightener, Thrive Cosmetics is your go-to for completing every fall look. Whether you want a simple, just gotta get out the door routine or fall glam that wows at all your favorite festivities, you'll always look and feel radiant with Thrive Cosmetics. Plus, every product is vegan, cruelty-free, and made with clean, skin-loving ingredients. Complete your fall look. Go to thrivecosmetics.com/cozy for an exclusive offer of 20% off your first order. That's Thrive Cosmetics. CAUSEMETICS.com/cozy.
I have two questions that they're actually the same question about two different topics in 2025, and it's, have you seen the likes ever? And number one is David Clifford. So he gets a third footballer of the year. So Jack O'Shea's on four overall in the grand scheme of things. So he's that to catch up on. But for many people, David Clifford is the greatest. And then the other, have you ever seen the likes, is the All-Ireland Hurling Final this year? Because you've seen it all, or certainly a lot.
Yeah, in both cases, you'd have to say that, you know, that it's hard to say that you have, because David Clifford's reputation was forged at underage. He came through. I mean, he in a funny way, kind of cost Kerry an under 20 title, because they immediately, graded himself and Shawnee O'Shea as senior, so they weren't available to Jack O'Connor's under 20s at the time. But from the time he came through, not only did he have a reputation, but when he was an 18-year-old in his first season, he was pulling the last gasp goal out of the bag to stop Kerry losing to Monaghan up in Clonus in an All-Ireland group match. But Kerry haven't been the dominant force they were, say, during Jack O'Shea's career. Maybe they will be from now on. But in terms of his play, I mean, because Kerry often produce great, you know, generational forwards, like Kenny Hurlers. But he's managed to impact at a very consistent level, because he's only 26 at the moment. So in other words, now interesting, I looked it up, and he's not that much younger than Jack O'Shea was when he got his last Footballer of the Year award. So I don't know whether how the future years will pan out, but it looks good for Kerry at the moment, both in terms of the general competitive environment and the players that they have at their disposal. But I mean, he's able to do extraordinary things in the biggest of matches with the maximum impact, even to the extent of in the final, you know, when he just sort of occupied Brendan McCall and allowed space for others. And if others got notions, like Tyrone did in the semi-final, and he gets even a glimmer of extra space himself, but then he becomes the instrument of punishment.
So yeah,
he is. I mean, he's been a very dominant player in the game, particularly for a team that's not guaranteed to win All-Ireland.
We won't see that great point that he scored in stoppage time in first half now with the buzzer reverting.
That's right, yeah. And I think, I don't know if that drove it, because in a way it was the sort of, it was a piece of evidence for...
It was used.
It was a piece of evidence in favour of the rule. And in fact, it sort of punished Donegal's tentativeness in not pushing out and competing.
But Paddy was just having the ball to himself, wasn't he, for a few seconds?
Exactly. Yeah. And then eventually, he was just waiting. Mm. And Brendan McColl was sort of, you know, fixated on him.
Yeah.
But as soon as he got the step, it's and a 2-point, and it went from a 5-point deficit to a 7-point deficit, from Donegal probably maybe feeling okay about themselves at halftime to feeling they were really up against it. So yeah, that was a really big moment.
Where do you fall on the comparison of the modern greats? Like, there's no doubt Clifford's a great, like that game was a great example of where, in one sense, he didn't play brilliant, but he done all brilliant things, took people on a walk out to the sideline to create space. But in the modern media we're in now, where everybody is so Instagrammable, and like, you would have seen a lot of the greats in the last 20, 30 years, but they wouldn't have had the same profile at times because of the modern media. Does that influence how people perceive people?
Definitely. And also, there is a recency bias as well, because people are seeing this at the moment. But, you know, certain things are comparable. And, the performance, obviously, for forwards, output. And in the biggest of matches, like poor Joyce scoring 10 points against me in the 2001 final, you know, I mean, that's a stellar performance, whatever era it takes place in. But I fall somewhere in the middle. I'm not taken up with recency bias, but I would always have pushed back against anyone who was saying, whether it's, you know, emails to me or that, questioning the Dublin team that won all the All-Irelands, saying, oh, you know, they're not as good as this, that. But the only measure of how good a team is really is what it wins, and they created a record in terms of winning. I had interesting correspondence in pre-email days with a man in Wicklow who had seen the Kerry 4-in-a-row team 29-32. And he reckoned they were better than Mick O'Dwyer's team. And I mean, sure, how could I say? I mean, I'm talking to someone who'd seen them both. Yeah. And that was his view. But I am wary of kind of going into too much intergenerational comparisons, because contexts are different.
And it's an argument that no one's ever won in the history of sport.
No.
Sporting debate. We would say, for instance, Michael here in the YouTube comments in the live stream says, Marth Fitz is better than David Clifford. You know, and if someone feels that staunchly about that, they're not going to change their minds.
True, yeah. And I don't know, like, Darragh Cadeja would probably say the same thing. He thinks that Morris was that, and without sort of intending any disrespect to David Clifford. And that plays a role too. I mean, when we, these teams, the Millennium and teams of the Centenary teams, I remember looking at the composition of the journalists who selected them, and they would have all sort of been around the same age, and they would have been all kind of youngish in the 40s and 50s, and when you're probably most susceptible and impressionable, and sure enough, that's where the kind of the critical mass of the players came from.
Yeah. We took it going with your list just before that, the hurling final. Like, we have seen blowouts before, but this was seismic.
Sure, yeah. And then we saw, I mean, remember in 94 when Limerick lost that lead to Offaly in the, I mean, it was something like two goals and 6 points in 4 minutes, 14 seconds, and, you know, turned the 5-point lead into a 6-point deficit, just like that. But this was extraordinary, because the feeling would have been at halftime, like, Tip had done well. Like, Tip were playing well. Tip weren't going to get hammered the way they had done twice before down in Cork. And yet, Shane Barrett got in for the goal before half time, and you thought, oh, Cork would be happy enough.
Six points.
What surprised me afterwards, talking to people, was how adamant Tipperary were that at half time they were fully confident they were going to win. They said, we have this now. That wouldn't mean the ambient view around the place. You know, thought that Cork had put a reasonable lead up, but no one would have foreseen what happened. And Patrick Horgan missed a free start.
That would have been 7.
Would have pushed it out to 7. And I mean, the scale of the meltdown was such that it's hard to pin it all on that. But maybe it would have settled them a little bit. But Tip were excellent. I mean, it was funny the way that as the manager of Tip, when they were both under 21 and under 20, just on the cusp of the turnover between the age grades, Liam Cahill did the same thing. Lost a Munster final, I think it was, to Cork pretty heftily, and yet came back by the All-Ireland final and beat them. Not by you know, a huge margin, but beat them, just overturned that verdict. And that was hanging out there a little bit before the final, but nothing on the scale that happened in the second half.
And a quick question, and as a journalist, how do you record Pat Ryan and all of that? Because Hero to Zero was do you have to be careful with that? There's a human side of it. Has he failed as a manager ultimately on that day?
Well, the team failed, so the management takes their share of the culpability in it. But it was a strange year for him. I mean, it was a terrible year in some ways, personal bereavement, but also great success and success on very Cork terms in the league. You know, swashbuckling goal scoring. And I suppose in a way the canary in the coal mine was how they started the championship. I was in Ennis for that, and it was business as usual up till half time. I mean, they were swatting Clare, and then in the second half it slowed down a bit, and Shane Barrett got sent off. I think it was the 59th minute he got sent off, and Cork were leading by 9, and it kind of gave birth to this orthodoxy that you cannot win a match in hurling a man short for any significant amount of time. And in the end, Cork were just simply lucky to draw that match, because Clare actually got the puck out after taking the lead, and just the ball got, I think it was Dave McInerney, was under pressure, and he was judged to have fouled the ball, and Patrick Horgan drew it. But that was a bit of Cork vulnerability we hadn't seen during the league. And now they got back on track, but then they got murdered by Limerick in the Gaelic rounds, and you're thinking, crikey, this shouldn't be happening. I know this in the past, and it's a useful kind of process, but teams have had resets where they get a bad setback. Yeah. Tip had it in 2019, and then you get back on the horse. No one expects it to happen in the space of a few days, which effectively it was.
20 days,
Before the Munster final. And for Cork to win that, I mean, that was remarkable. And then it looked like they were back in business. Probably didn't do them any favours. They're playing Dublin in the semi-final and went to town
and
on
the space
them.
Between the games, it just felt like the Munster final was it for them, really, wasn't it?
Well, they seem to have difficulty refocusing. I mean, in a way, you know, it went fine for them in the semi-final. Dublin be disappointed, but it went fine for Cork. But maybe they were too much of a team still in development to handle that kind of extreme, and it was just in the second half, like on every metric, they're wiped out, and it was not as tough on Pat Ryan. But I think Pat Ryan would have stayed on, but I think the county board wants, or the county executive wanted, some changes made to the backroom.
It's fine margins, isn't it, for the man? Jeez.
And he would have been loyal to the people that he had. So I mean, he could conceivably reappear as manager after a few years. There's probably no harm to change from time to time, but I'm sure he's frustrated he didn't get the opportunity to finish the job.
It's an extraordinary year in sport. It was 2025, and your first century was an extraordinary year in Irish life, 1972, which is the Five Nations at Twickenham. So Ireland were away to England, knowing that if they had won, they were going to be level on points with Wales. And when they did, 16 points to 12, Kevin Flynn, the centre, getting the try that won the game. But you're only a pup at this stage, are you?
What happened? It was a significant try in family terms, because my grandmother had died only a few days previously, and we lived together with them, so it was a big shock. It was the first death in the family I was aware of, and I remember the following Saturday Ireland won in Paris for the beat France for the first time in 20 years,
mm-hmm.
And it was the introduction. It was an all reliable in pub quizzes who scored Ireland's first 4-point try, Johnny Maloney, the Mary scrum half, and they won that. And that was unusual. It hadn't happened since the '50s. Then they're away. Their first two matches are away. So then I don't know when it was organised, but my father and grandfather decided they'd go to Twickenham and bring me along, and off we went. And of course the I'm sure my late father could find himself up for Tuzla, but I remember my father and grandfather. We arrived at the ground, didn't have to pre-book or acquire it, and they go up and they get two stand tickets for themselves and give me a terrace ticket. So I disappear up onto the terrace. I'm 11 at this stage, and I'm right behind the goal where Ireland scored the second half tries, and the Kevin Flynn one happened more or less in front of me. And this was kind of sensational, because they were not that they would have been unused to beating England, but it was a really big win late on, and that made them 2 out of 2 with the whole matches to come, and then because of the aftermath of Bloody Sunday and the burning of the British Embassy and everything, Scotland and Wales wouldn't travel, and so the only time the championship was abandoned, was unfinished, and. Ireland never got their crack at a Grand Slam that year.
Wow.
having done the hard work. In fairness to France, the French team came over in April and played in a friendly international, at which the tickets for the Scotland and Wales matches were accepted, and sort of helped out the IRFU financially, which should be remembered to them. But that was a huge disappointment.
Your next entry is 1983, the All-Ireland football final between Dublin and Galway. This is extraordinary.
Yeah.
This goes down that anyone alive at the time will tell you all about it, and you can look back and reading in the years, it's a great entry that year. So you're at this point, you're early 20s?
Yeah.
So have you at this point gone into journalism?
How
does this work?
No, I'm just finished college, and I've been interested. I was interested in rugby, soccer, go to League of Ireland matches, and in football and hurling. But I was very much a kind of a casual engager, and I went to the drawn Cork Dublin match that year, but I didn't go down to Cork for the famous replay.
Which Dublin won, yeah. My father's still sore about that from a Cork perspective. Yeah, well, that one.
Yeah, but it's a little to be sore about.
Not the replay.
The replay was a big win for Dublin.
Yeah,
yeah. The replay, because the goal, Barney Rourke's goal right at the end, just drew it back. I mean, yeah, they were beaten, but for that, and it was an important day in GA terms, because they were report they received afterwards about the event. So they nearly had a disaster on Hill 16. I mean, Hill 16 at that stage actually had kind of grassy banks and things. And they came close to a really serious catastrophe, you know.
Overcrowding.
Sorges. And just the unsuitability of the terracing.
Panning spoke about this last week too.
It was a crazy time. It was mad. And even, like my own experience, I rambled along kind of far too close to the throw-in. In those days, you see, you could pay in. Mm. I think that possibly was the last All-Ireland final that was all ticket. It used to be just the stands were ticket. And I arrived along, and we're there at the canal end, and there were gates were shut, and I said, no, it's full. And what happened then was that fellas began kind of pushing away on the gates, and someone got his hand up the inside and unbolted it. And then they were pushing, and people were scrambling up underneath the lintel. It'd take a mistimed push, and somebody cut in half. So on the inside, they said, geez, we better just open it up. I mean, this is kind of connotations of Leppings Lane and Hillsborough, you know.
Yeah.
In we all went, and up the terrace. I think the match was possibly started a short amount of time at that stage. and kind of pushed in. The canal end was really full as a result. I remember because it rained very heavily during that match, and yet, so only my head and my shoulder pads actually go wet. So kind of wedged in. But it was a remarkable match. We were there at that end, and you were kind of assuming, like, oh, we have to win this ultimately. I remember when T and G were running the old All-Irelands, Ireland goals, saying to Barney Rock when I was talking to him just the week after, by coincidence, I'd seen the 83 final, and even watching it in the 90s, I still couldn't believe they'd won, you know.
It is remarkable. Like, there's so much defining imagery from that game alone. Like, so Dublin finished with 12, Galway 14.
The Dirty Dozen Dublin were called?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
It's almost hard to know who's getting sent off when.
Not all the sendings off registered with people. It was kind of reduced to saying, where's
Brian Mullins was first, wasn't he? And then there was a double red.
That was prominent, and you could see that happening.
But the next one after, where there was confusion.
Ray Hazley got sent off, people were saying, where's Hazley? I haven't seen Hazley. She'd been sent off. It was interesting for me, because that really kind of got me interested in the whole thing, and I started going to all the Dublin matches and getting lifts with people to the matches outside of Dublin, and became far more kind of tuned into it rather than casually. So it was a significant final, I must say.
Barney Rock's goal as well, the imagery of that, and Pádraig Coyne, wasn't it, the running back to goal, and then Joe McNally putting it over the bar.
That's
when he's
right.
through,
was,
and he's lamenting. He's lamenting.
You can see,
himself.
You can see what he was going for. Yeah. He wasn't going for a point.
So when did you get involved in journalism?
I started in journalism kind of accidentally. What happened was I was working in PR, and one of the clients was sponsoring a team in the junior Ross cycling race.
Yeah.
And I said, God, I'll try and get some coverage for this. And a college friend of mine, Jared Siggins, was in the Sunday Tribune Sports Department. And I said to him, geez, would you make sure that this appears like this? And he said, yeah, but will you get me results and a few paragraphs on it? So I duly went off and did that and rang it in on the Saturday. And I said to him afterwards, if you want me to do anything else, like, I'd be happy to do other
things. Famous
last
words.
Yeah. I remember leaving a pub full of friends when they were about to watch Ireland Scotland in a rugby international, because I was going off to Harold's Cross to do a League of Ireland match for the Tribune. And then at a certain stage, having done, I did, for instance, in the 89 snooker championship in Goffs. So I did the Saturday there, and I was kind of enjoying it. And I decided then, I went along to him and I said, would there be enough work for me to be able to kind of earn a livelihood? And he said, well, sure, you know, come along and we'll see. You could do some subbing, sub editing, and that. In 89, I made the jump. I just said, I'm going getting out of PR, and what I'm going to do is I'm going to do this, and it was perfect, because I was able to get sub editing shifts, which were paid. You were paid a certain amount for your shift, so that was a kind of a foundation income. And then I was able to write things, and you were paid per word. So between the two, I was able to keep going without freelancing in the kind of the traditional sense of going around other papers and saying, you know, I'm available to do work at the weekend. I kind of got embedded in the Tribune. Now, the Tribune weren't fast to staff anyone, so that was never really going to happen. But I was part of the furniture there for a good 2 years. And there were when I went in, like, I mean, David Walsh was there, Jerry Thornley was there, people who came on board like Brendan Fanning, Dennis Walsh,
great generation,
and we all would have met in there.
Yeah.
And then it became clear I wasn't going to be staffed in there, so another friend of mine from college, who again I reacquainted with in the Tribune, Alan Ruddock, was a sports journalist who unfortunately died back in 2010. But he set up the Irish edition of the Sunday Times. And said to me, do you want to do? We come in and do GA stuff for us. And so I did that. And then I started to do some sub-editing shifts in the Irish Times. And that was kind of my new model of earning until the staff job in the Times came up in 94. So that was kind of how I made my way into it. And it was, I think if I wasn't... Eugene McGee was another one who was there when I arrived in the Tribune. He left to go to the Evening Herald, and another chap called Paul Desmond suddenly decided to go to London. Left me the only one who was writing consistently about Gaelic games. We'd Kevin Cashman doing hurling, and I just started doing football. So it was as random as that.
Yeah.
The speciality was as random as that.
It's kind of different there,
So, yeah.
All right, we've about 10 minutes left here to rattle through the next three. So, Italian 90, your soccer entry. Yeah. Ireland won, England won. What's more to say about this? Gary Lineker scores for England, Kevin Sheedy for Ireland.
Yeah, that's right. That was in the Tribune. I was involved in the Vincent Brown bought the rights off FIFA for the official FIFA publication. And we had to put it together and put in the squads and all text and everything. And it was a big undertaking, done very, very quickly. He rewarded a couple of us by putting us on a charter flight that was taking a bunch of Tribune people over to Cagliari in the morning and out that night. But it was fantastic because as a kid I was mad keen on the World Cup. I always. It's kind of a fascination. I have to say it's probably abated in more recent years. But I remember in like the 16-team World Cup in 1970 and all of the rest of it. So for Ireland to be in a World Cup like was a huge, huge thing. And to be able to see their very first match in a World Cup, that was very big for me. Yeah. I still had the ticket at home. And the match itself, it didn't look great.
It was a dire match, was it?
It wasn't a great match. The Italian press were appalled by it. Like, we're seeing the papers the next day.
And you have a problem if they're appalled by it.
That's true.
So, we went to a restaurant, went from the restaurant to the airport. We were there about 5 in the morning. But it was amazing that they actually dug the result out because there were some... I think there was a kind of a question. Alan McLaughlin, who was a late addition to the squad, poor old Gary Waddock got dumped, and poor old Alan McLaughlin actually died since. But there was a suggestion: was he offside when Sheedy scored the goal?
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
And of course, then he went on to score the vital goal in Windsor Park.
Windsor Park
when Ireland qualified for the 94 World Cup. Yep. But that was a brilliant event.
Hell of a team. Bonner, Mick, Kevin Moore and Chris Morris, John Aldridge, Steve Staunton, Andy Townsend, Sheedy, of course, Tony Cascarino, Ray Houghton and Paul McGrath, starting lineup.
Oh, yeah.
Amazing.
Funny enough, I think their best team, their peak, was the 88 European Championship.
All right, yeah. Ronnie Whelan and...
They were, and Stapleton was... Yeah. But just in terms, I remember the lead up to that... Johan Cruyff was on BBC Sports Night and he was asked about it was one of the revolving pundits being asked about it, and he said, you know, dark horses, he said, the Republic of Ireland, he said, they're comfortable with the way they play and they're not afraid of anything. And because I could remember Cruyff in the 74 World Cup, and it was amazing to hear him sort of name check Ireland as being, you know, there were only eight teams in that European Championship.
Yeah. Where were you for this game, Ireland England Italian 90? Do you remember?
Not sure. I do remember the game, obviously. Yeah. Sheedy's goal from just outside the box, wasn't it? Where he.
He attempts a pass and the pass is awful, but it comes back to him.
It comes back off Steve McMahon.
I think you're right.
I met Sheedy, my brother's pubs in New York, and my brother Matthew had an Everton night there 5 years ago, and he asked Kevin Sheedy to come over. I was surprised that he'd never been in New York before, but anyway, he went over, and I was to kind of interview him in the pub, and he said that there'd been a certain amount of ill feeling between himself and McMahon, so he's particularly pleased. There was McMahon.
Liverpool Everton rivalry back then.
Well, of course, and he'd come from Liverpool.
Yeah,
as well.
Yeah, yeah.
He'd,
I can only apologise now, time's against us. We might do the last two together. They're two. Okay. They're a pair of All-Ireland finals. So the first is 1996, the hurling version, when Wexford beat Limerick by 113 to 14 points. Their first All-Ireland since 1968. And the second is the 2011 football final, where Dublin beat Kerry by a point, of course. So we'll take the Wexford one first. Incredible scenes. Liam Griffin running across the pitch and Martin Story lifting.
Yeah, the thing is, I mean, they both come under, both those matches come under the heading of family, really, because we, my mother-in-law retired to Wexford. Some of her children had moved there, and she went down there at the end of her life, and we were with the road beaten, worn out between Dublin and Curraghlow, going backwards and forwards, and the summer and the kids with us. Now, I remember the summer of '96 and Wexford coming through. And I mean, it's so extraordinary because their background, the team of the 50s. So I got to know Billy Rackard a bit. Well, one of the famous Rackard brothers. I interviewed him before the '96 final, and he was comparing them with '96. And he said back in his day, the thing he remembers most is all the cars were black and there were very few women around. Although if you see footage from Croke Park, there's a few women around, all right. But in 96, they came through. And remember, they had a man sent off before half time.
Right.
And they still managed to see it out. They didn't concede a scorable free, I think, in the second half. There was some stat like that. So it was a really kind of focused performance. But it's funny because that's their only, like, next year it'll be 30 years since that win.
It's amazing.
And in 96, it was 28 years.
Yeah, so, did it feel like the start of something then?
Not sure. It was a great time in Hurling because Clare had won the year before, and now Wexford.
It was in between,
won,
wasn't it?
The sandwich. And they won one more Leinster.
Yeah.
But it faded off. You see, they were a mature team. They'd been around a while. They weren't like Clare, who were mostly younger players.
Yeah.
But just remember the atmosphere in Wexford was fantastic. I drove up from Curraghlow on the morning. And just looking at the place as you drove through.
That's what I was brought to thinking about what the atmosphere would have been like at that time, because it had been so long. There, again, it's the imagery about this George O'Connor's hands, Tom Dempsey's goal, Joe Quaid's save in the second half, and then the melee that resulted from it.
That's right. Yeah. But no, they were. Yeah, they, it was. They Griffin was such a. He was such a clever manager. I mean, on that road. Up to Dublin, you know, I think it was for the Leinster final, which they hadn't won in ages either. He stopped the bus and made them walk across the Wexford Wicklow boundary, and said, "Now we do that again. We'll have the Bob O'Keefe Cup," which they did. But it was a real. I remember my sister in law lived there. She wouldn't be a big GA family. If anything, they're more into Curraghlow United, the soccer club down there. But just remember, she got the kids up to bring them in to town to see it, because you mightn't see it again, and she hasn't been wrong so far.
Yeah, totally. And then your final selection, 2011. So Dublin's first All-Ireland in 16 years, and I guess it was the start of something.
Yes, it was very much the start of something. It was interesting from my point of view. My eldest, my daughter Rebecca, was due to be born the Friday before the hurling final in 1993, and didn't arrive until the day before the football final. So anyway, she that sort of All-Ireland background going on. But on that day in 2011, that was her 18th birthday, and she went in with her sister and to watch the match. And you know, it was a match that, because Dublin hadn't beaten Kerry in the championship since 1977 at that stage, not for the want of trying. There'd been about 10 matches. So anyway, I remember being surprised at half time that it was so tight, and thinking, well, you know, they're giving a good account of themselves. But when they got the goal, I remember Joe Brolly on the television saying that the ground shook when Kevin McMenamin scored the goal. And but when Donaghy equalised, you kind of assumed, oh God, it's going to be a replay, because no one in the press box likes replays. But then, you know, it played out. I know there's, you know, when Clarkson was lining us up, that.
Yeah, talk to us about that.
Rebecca was sitting on the floor of the stand, almost clutching her head, and her younger sister was kind of giving her the commentary on what was happening, and and where it was going. And you could kind of, because the hill was behind it, the trajectory, the hill was responding to the trajectory. So you kind of heard it before you saw it almost. Yeah. And it was just extraordinary that team. Now, they had appeared the year before. They'd been competitive with Cork, and won it the year before. But to beat Kerry in the final was such a huge thing. And, of course, it as you say, like, triggered this run, this huge run of success.
It nearly typifies what Dublin's about, because if you think about Cluxton, there was almost no emotion. It was just like, bump, over the bar, jog back, machine-like. Yeah. And it was the start of that machine-like Dublin run, wasn't it?
Yeah, he was 10 years in goal at that stage, and he went on to play, you know, another 12, and he was in goal for all of those All-Irelands.
He appeared to get greater as time went on.
Well, he became, that thing with the kickouts only became really a thing around the mid-2000s. I remember because Shane Ryan was the centre fielder and he'd pick him out on runs to the wing. But he was such a huge influence on that as captain and everything.
Sean Moore, that was brilliant. You had to be there. Brilliant one to end 2025. Thanks a million for coming in.
No problem.